The 13th Candle by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Explanation. The 13th Candle, well, it is meant to be a logical title derived from what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to light a candle, which is far better than cursing the darkness. This is my 13th book, which, I hope, will be my 13th candle. You may think it is a very little candle, perhaps one of those birthday cake candles. But I have never had a cake of any kind with candles, never even had a birthday cake. And now, with my restricted, sugar-free, low-residue diet of not more than 1,000 calories, it's too late to bother. So, indulge me. Let's pretend that this is the 13th candle, even though it be as small as the candle on a doll's birthday cake. Chapter 1. Mrs. Martha McGoogley strode purposefully to her kitchen door, a tattered scrap of newspaper clutched in a ham-like hand. Outside, in the parched patch of weed-covered ground, which served as back garden, she stopped and glared around like a cross bull in the mating season, awaiting the advent of rivals. Satisfied or disappointed that there were no rivals for attention in the offing, she hurried to the broken-down fence defining the garden limits. Gratefully propping her more than ample bosom on a worm-eaten post, she shut her eyes, opened her mouth, and, "Hey, Maud!" she roared across the adjoining gardens, her voice echoing and reverberating from the nearby factory wall. "Hey, Maud, where are ya?" Closing her mouth and opening her eyes, she stood awaiting the results. From the direction of the next house but one came the sound of a plate dropping and smashing, and then the kitchen door of that house opened, and a small, scraggy woman came hopping out, agitatedly wiping her hands on her ragged apron. "Well," she growled dourly, "what do you want?" "Hey, Maud, you seen this?" yelled back Martha as she waved a tattered piece of newsprint over her head. "How do I know if I seen it if I haven't seen it first?" snorted Maud. "I might have done. Then, on the other hand, I might not. What is it, anyhow, another sex scandal?" Mrs. Martha McGoogley fumbled in the pocket of her apron and withdrew large horn-rimmed spectacles, lavishly besprinkled with small stones. Carefully she wiped the glasses on the bottom of her skirt before putting them on and patting her hair in place over her ears. Then, noisily wiping her nose on the back of her sleeve, she yelled out, "It's from the Dominion. My nephew sent it to me." "Dominion? What shop is that? Have they got a sale on?" called Maud, with the first show of interest. Martha snorted in rage and disgust. "No," she shouted in exasperation, "don't ye know nothink? Dominion, you know, Canada. Dominion of Canada. My nephew sent it to me. Wait a minute, I'll be right over." Hoisting her bosom off the fence and tucking her glasses into her apron pocket, she sped down the rough garden and into the lane at the bottom. Maud sighed with resignation and slowly went to meet her. "Look at this," yelled Martha, as they met in the lane at the garden gate of the empty lot between the two houses. "Look at the rot they're writing now. Soul, there ain't no such thing. When you're dead, you're dead. Just like that, poof." Her face flushed. She brandished the paper under poor Maud's long, thin nose and said angrily, "How did they get away with it? I don't never know. You die. It's like blowing out a candle and nothing after. My poor husband, God rest his soul, always said before he died that it would be such a relief to know that he wouldn't meet his past associates again." She sniffed to herself at the mere thought. Maud O'Haggis looked down the sides of her nose and waited patiently for her crony to run down. At last she seized her opportunity and asked, "But what is this article which has so upset you?" Speechlessly, Martha McGoogley passed over the tattered fragment of paper that had caused all the commotion. "No, dear," she suddenly said, having found her voice again, "that's the wrong side you're reading." Maud turned over the paper and started all over again, her lips silently forming the words as she read them. "Well," she exclaimed, "well, I never." Martha smiled with triumphant satisfaction. "Well, it's a rum do, eh? With such stuff you can get into print, what do you make of that?" Maud turned over the page a few times, started to read the wrong side again, and then said, "Oh, I know Helen Hensbaum will tell us. She knows all about these things. She reads books." "I can't bear that woman," retorted Martha. "Say, do you know what she said to me the other day? She said, 'May beets grow in your belly.' God forbid, Mrs. McGoogley. That's what she said to me. Can you imagine it? The cheek of that woman! Ugh. But she got the gen, you know. She knows her stuff about these things. And if we want to get to the bottom of this," she violently fluttered the poor unfortunate sheet of paper, "we shall have to play her game and butter her up. Come on, let's go see her." Martha pointed down the lane and said, "There she is, hanging out her smalls. Fancy hussy she is, I must say. Get a load of them new pantyhose. Must be on a special somewhere. Me, good old-fashioned knickers is good enough for me." She raised her skirt to show. "Keeps you warmer when there's no man about, eh?" She laughed coarsely, and the two women sauntered down the lane towards Helen Hensbaum and her washing. Just as they were about to turn into the Hensbaum garden, the sound of a slamming door halted them. From the adjacent garden, a pair of the hottest hot pants appeared. Fascinated, the two women stared. Slowly their gaze traveled upwards to take in the see-through blouse and vapid, painted face. "Struth," muttered Maud O'Haggis, "there's life in the old town yet." Silently they stood and goggled as the young girl in the hot pants teetered by on heels as high as her morals were low. "Makes you feel old, like, don't it?" said Martha McGoogley. Without another word, they turned into the Hensbaum place to find Mrs. Hensbaum watching the girl going on the beat.
"The top of the morning to you, Mrs. Hensbaum," called Martha. "I see you have sights at your end of the lane, eh?"
She gave a throaty chuckle. Helen Hensbaum scowled even more ferociously as she looked down the lane.
"Ugh, her," she exclaimed. "Dead in her mother's womb she should be already."
She sighed and stretched up her high clothesline, demonstrating that she did wear pantyhose.
"Mrs. Hensbaum," began Maud, "we know as how you're very well read, and you know all such things, so we've come to you for advice."
She stopped, and Helen Hensbaum smiled as she said,
"Well, now, ladies, come in. I will make a cup of tea for you this cold morning. It'll do us all good to rest a while." She turned and led the way into her well-kept home, which had the local name of Little Germany, because it was so neat and tidy. The kettle was boiling, the tea was steaming. Mrs. Hensbaum passed around sweet biscuits and then said, "Now, what can I do for you?" Maud gestured to Martha and said, "She's got a queer sort of tale from Canada or some such outlandish place. Don't know what to make of it myself, but she'll tell you." Martha sat up straighter and said, "Here, look at this. I got it from my nephew. Got himself in trouble over a married woman, he did, and he scurried off to a place called Montreal in the Dominion. Writes sometimes, just sent this in his letter. Don't believe in such stuff." She passed over the tattered scrap of paper, now much the worse for rough handling. Mrs. Helen Hensbaum gingerly took the remnant and spread it out on a clean sheet of paper. "Ah, so," she yelped in her excitement, quite forgetting her normally excellent English. "Is good, no? Will you read it out to us clear like and tell us what you think?" asked Maud. So Mrs. Hensbaum cleared her throat, sipped her tea, and started. "From the Montreal Star, I see, Monday, May 31st, 1971. Interesting. Yes, I have been to that city." A short pause, and she read out, "Saw himself leave his body. Heart victim describes dying feeling. Canadian Press, Toronto. A Toronto man who suffered a heart attack last year says he saw himself leave his body and had strange, tranquil sensations during a critical period when his heart stopped. B. Leslie Sharp, 68, says during the period his heart was not beating, he was able to observe himself face to face. Mr. Sharp describes his experience in the current issue of the Canadian Medical Association Journal in part of a report by Dr. R. L. McMillan and Dr. K. W. G. Brown, co-directors of the Coronary Care Unit of Toronto General Hospital. In the report, the doctors said, this could be the concept of the soul leaving the body. Mr. Sharp was taken to hospital after his family doctor diagnosed a pain in his left arm as a heart attack. The following morning, Mr. Sharp says, he remembers glancing at his watch while lying in bed, hooked to the wires of a cardiograph machine and intravenous tubes. Just then, I gave a very, very deep sigh, and my head flopped over to the right. I thought, why did my head flop over? I didn't move it. I must be going to sleep. Then I am looking at my own body from the waist up, face to face as though from a mirror, in which I appear to be in the lower left corner. Almost immediately I saw myself leaving my body, coming out through my head and shoulders. I did not see my lower limbs. The body leaving me was not exactly in vapor form, yet it seemed to expand very slightly once it was clear of me, said Mr. Sharp. Suddenly, I am sitting on a very small object, traveling at great speed, out and up into a dull blue-gray sky at about a 45-degree angle. Down below me, to my left, I saw a pure white, cloud-like substance also moving up on a line that would intersect my course. It was perfectly rectangular in shape, but full of holes, like a sponge. My next sensation was of floating in a bright pale yellow light, a very delightful feeling. I continued to float, enjoying the most beautiful, tranquil sensation. Then there were sledgehammer blows to my left side. They created no actual pain, but jarred me so much that I had difficulty in retaining my balance. I began to count them, and when I got to six, I said out loud, "What the are you doing to me?" And I opened my eyes. He said he recognized doctors and nurses around his bed who told him he had suffered a cardiac arrest and he had been defibrillated, shocked by electrical pulses to start his heart beating normally. The doctors said it was unusual for a heart attack patient to remember events surrounding the attack, and that, usually, there was a period of amnesia for several hours before and after an attack. "Well," exclaimed Helen Hensbaum as she concluded her reading and sat back to gaze at the two women before her. "How very interesting." Martha McGoogley smirked with self-satisfied pleasure that she had shown the foreign woman something she had not known before. "Good, eh?" she smiled. "The real original McCoy of bunk, eh?" Helen Hensbaum smiled in a quizzical sort of way as she asked, "So, you think this is strange, no? You think it is the, what do you call it, the bunk?" "No, ladies, this is ordinary. Look here, I show." She jumped to her feet and led the way into another room. There, in a very smart bookcase, reposed books. More books than Martha had ever seen in a house before. Mrs. Helen Hensbaum moved forward and picked out certain books. "Look," she exclaimed, rifling the pages as one handling old and beloved friends. "Look, here is all this and more in print. The truth brought to us by one man who has been penalized and persecuted for telling the truth, and now, just because some silly pressman writes an article, people can believe it is true." Mrs. Martha McGoogley looked curiously at the titles. "The Third Eye? Doctor from Lhasa? Where's that?" she muttered before scanning the rest of the titles. Then turning round, she exclaimed, "You don't believe that stuff, do you, Cor? Flip me bloomin' eyelids, that's fiction." Helen Hensbaum laughed out loud. "Fiction," she gasped at last. "Fiction. I have studied these books, and I know they are true. Since reading you forever, I too can astral travel." Martha looked blank. "Poor doll is mixing German with her English," she thought. "Astral travel, what's that? A new airline or something?" Maud just stood there with her mouth hanging open. All this was much beyond her. All she wanted to read was the Sunday supplement with all the latest sex crimes. "This oostral, astral travel, or whatever it is, whatever is it?" asked Martha. "Is there really anything in it? Could my old man, who's dead and gone, God rest his soul, come to me and tell me where he stashed his money before he croaked?" "Yes, I tell you he could. It could be done if there was a real reason for it. If it were for the good of others, yes. "Heepers, jeepers, cats and creepers!" ejaculated a flustered Martha. "Now I'll be afraid to sleep tonight in case my old man comes back to haunt me and gets up his old capers again." She shook her head sadly as she muttered, "He always was a great one in the bedroom." Helen Hansbaum poured out more tea. Martha McGoogley fingered the books. "Say, Mrs. H., would you lend me one of these?" she asked. Mrs. Hansbaum smiled. "No," she replied, "I never lend my books, because an author has to live on the pitiful sum which is called a royalty. 7% it is, I believe. If I lend books, then I'm depriving an author of his living." She lapsed into silent thought and then exclaimed, "I'll tell you what," she offered, "I will buy you a set as a gift, and then you could read the truth for yourself. Fair enough?" Martha shook her head dubiously. "Well, I don't know," she said, "I just don't know. I don't like the thought that when we have to put away a body all tidy-like and screwed him down in his box and then shoveled him in the earth that he's going to come back all spooky-like and scare the living daylights out of us." Maud felt rather out of things. She thought it was time for her to put in her 2 cents worth. "Yes," she said hesitantly. "When we send him up that crematorium chimney in a cloud of that greasy smoke, well, that should be the end of that." "But look," interrupted Martha with a cross glance at Maud, "if, as you say, there is life after death, why is there no proof? They are gone. That's the last we hear of them. Gone. If they did live on, they would get in touch with us. God forbid." Mrs. Hansbaum sat silently for a moment, then rose and moved to a small writing desk. "Look," she said as she returned with the photograph in her hands. "Look at this. This is a photograph of my twin brother. He's a prisoner of the Russians, held in Siberia. We know he is alive because the Swiss Red Cross have told us so. Yet we cannot get a message from him. I'm his twin, and I know he is alive." Martha sat and stared at the photograph and turned the frame over and over in her hands. "My mother is in Germany, East Germany. She, too, is alive, but we cannot communicate. Yet these two people are still on this earth, still with us. And supposing you have a friend in, say, Australia, who you desire to telephone, even if you have his number, you still have to take account of the difference in time. You have to use some mechanical and electrical contrivances. And even then, you may not be able to speak to your friend. He may be at work or may be at play. And this is just to the other side of this world. Think of the difficulties of phoning to the other side of this life." Martha started to laugh. Oh, dear, Mrs. Hansbaum, you are a card," she chortled. "A telephone, she says, to the other side of life." "Hey, wait a minute, though," suddenly exclaimed Maud in high excitement. "Yes, sure, you have something there. My son is in electronics with the BBC, and he was telling us, you know how boys talk, about some old geezer who did invent such a telephone, and it worked. Micro frequencies or something like that. Then it was all hushed up. The church got in the act, I guess." Mrs. Hansbaum smiled her approval to Maud and added, "Yes, it is perfectly true. This author I've been telling you about knows a lot about the matter. The device is stopped for lack of money to develop it, I believe. But anyhow, messages do come through. There is no death.
Well, you prove it, exclaimed Martha rudely.
I can't prove it to you just like that, mildly replied Mrs. Hensbaum. But look at it like this. Take a block of ice and let it represent the body. The ice melts, which is the body decaying. And then we have water, which is the soul leaving.
Nonsense, exclaimed Martha. We can see the water, but show me the soul.
You interrupted me, Mrs. McGoogley, responded Mrs. Hensbaum. The water will evaporate into invisible vapor, and that represents the stage of life after death. Maud had been fretting because the conversation was leaving her behind. After several moments of hesitation, she said,
I suppose, Mrs. Hensbaum, if we want to get in touch with the dear departed, we go to a seance, who then puts us in touch with the spirits. Yeah?
Oh, dear, no,
laughed Martha, jealously guarding her position.
If you want spirits, you can go to the pub and get a drop of scotch. Old Mrs. Knickerbocker is supposed to be a good medium, and she does like the other kinds of spirits, too. Have you ever been to a seance, Mrs. Hensbaum?
Helen Hensbaum shook her head sadly.
No, ladies, she replied, I do not go to seances. I don't believe in them. Many of those who do go are sincere believers, but, oh, they're so greatly misled. She looked at the clock and jumped to her feet in agitated alarm.
Mein lieber Gott, she exclaimed, the lunch of my husband I should be getting already.
Recovering her composure, she continued more calmly. If you are interested, come along here at 3 this afternoon, and we will talk some more. But now, to my household duties, I must attend.
Martha and Maud rose to their feet and made for the door.
Yes, said Martha, speaking for both of them unasked. We will come again at 3, as you suggest.
Together they walked down the back garden and out into the back lane. Only once did Martha speak, when they were parting.
Well, I don't know, she remarked. I really don't know, but let's meet here at 2:50. See ya.
And she turned into her door, while Maud walked further up the lane to her own abode. In the Hensbaum house, Mrs. H. swept around in a fury of controlled Germanic efficiency, muttering strange words to herself, dishes and cutlery spewing from her hands to find their unerring places on the table, as if she were a highly paid juggler in a Berlin music hall. By the time the front gate clicked and the measured tread of her husband's footsteps reached the door, all was ready, and lunch was served. The sun had passed its high and was angling down to the western sky when Maud emerged from her door and sauntered jauntily down towards her friend's house. A stunning apparition she was, in a flowered print dress which smacked strongly of a bargain store near Wapping Steps.
"Yoo-hoo, Martha!"
she called as she reached the garden door. Martha opened the door and blinked dazedly at Maud.
"Blimey!" she said in an odd voice. "Scrambled eggs and sunset, eh?"
Maud bristled.
"Your skirt's too tight, Martha," she said. "You're showing the lines of your girdle and your knickers. Who are you to talk, anyhow?"
And of a truth, Martha did look a bit of a sight.
Her two-piece pearl gray skirt and jacket were almost indecently tight. A student of anatomy would have had no difficulty in locating the various landmarks, even including the Linnea Alba. Her high heels were so high that she had to strut, and the quite unnatural height gave her a tendency to tail wag or behind bounce. With her considerable endowments in the dairy bar department, she had to adopt a remarkable posture, like an American soldier on parade. Together, they paraded up the lane and entered the Hensbaum back garden. Mrs. Hensbaum opened the door at the first knock and ushered them in. "My, Mrs. Hensbaum, have you gone into the book-selling business?" "Oh, no, Mrs. O'Haggis," smiled the German woman. "I thought you were very interested in the psychic sciences, and so I bought a set of these Rampa books for each of you as a gift from me." "Gee," muttered Martha, fingering one of the books. "Strange-looking old fellow, isn't he? Does he really have a cat growing out of his head like this?" Mrs. Hensbaum laughed outright, her face purpling in the process. "Ach, no," she exclaimed. "Publishers take great liberties with the covers of books. The author has no say at all in the matter. Wait, I show you." And she dashed away upstairs to return, somewhat breathless, carrying a small photograph. "This is what the author looks like. I wrote to him, and he replied and sent me this, which I treasure." "But Mrs. Hensbaum," said Martha, in some exasperation as they sat discussing things, "Mrs. Hensbaum, you have no proof of anything. It's all fiction." "Mrs. McGoogley," replied Mrs. Hensbaum, "you are quite wrong. There is proof, but proof which has to be experienced, to be lived. My brother is in the hands of the Russians. I told a friend of mine, Miss Rhoda Carr, that he had visited me in the astral and told me that he was at a prison named Dnipropetrovsk. He said it was a very large prison complex in Siberia. I have never heard of it. Miss Rhoda Carr said nothing then, but some weeks later she wrote to me and confirmed it. She's connected with some sort of organization, and she was in a position to make inquiries through undercover friends in Russia. But, very interestingly, she told me that many people had been to tell her such things about relatives in Russia and all, she said, by occult means." Maud was sitting with her mouth open. Then she sat up straight and said, "My mother once told me that she went to a seance, and she was told some very strange things. Everything she was told came true. But why do you say that these seances are no good, Mrs. Hensbaum?" "No, I didn't say that all of them were no good. I said I did not believe in them. On the other side of death there are mischievous entities who can read one's thoughts and play games with people. They read the thoughts and then give messages, pretending that it is from some Indian guide or from some dear departed. Most of the messages are silly, meaningless, but sometimes, by accident, something comes through, which is fairly accurate." "They must blush a bit when they read my thoughts," sniggered Martha. "I was never a Sunday school girl." Mrs. Hensbaum smiled and continued, "People are very misled about those who have passed over. There they have work to do. They're not hanging around waiting or panting to answer silly questions. They have their work to do. Would you, Mrs. O'Haggis, welcome some silly telephone call when you were extremely busy and pressed for time? Would you, Mrs. McGoogly, welcome a nuisance at the door when you're already late for bingo?
No, she is right, you know, muttered Martha. But you said about Indian guides. I have heard about them. Why do they have to be Indian?
Ah, Mrs. McGoogly, pay no attention to such tales, answered Mrs. Hensbaum. People imagine Indian guides, imagine Tibetan guides, etc., etc., etc. Just think of it here. In this life, one may regard the Indian, the Tibetan, or the Chinese as poor, underprivileged, colored natives not worthy of a second thought. How, then, can we suddenly regard them as psychic geniuses as soon as they get to the other side? No, many most uninformed people adopt an Indian guide because it's more mysterious. Actually, one's only guide is one's over-self.
Oh, 'tis beyond us you're talking, Mrs. Hensbaum. You've lost us amid the words.
Mrs. Hensbaum laughed and replied, It is so. The books you should first read, maybe, starting with The Third Eye.
And if I be so bold, may we come and talk to you again? Asked Maud Haggis.
Oh, yes, indeed you may, for it will be my pleasure, replied Mrs. Hensbaum hospitably. Why do we not arrange to meet here at this time, 1 week from today? And so, a few minutes later, the two ladies were ambling along the lane again, each carrying a load of books, which were the gifts of Mrs. Helen Hensbaum.
I wish she had said a little bit more about what happens when we die, though, said Maud wistfully.
Oh, you'll know soon enough by the looks of you, responded Martha.
The lights burned long at the McGoogly and O'Haggis residences. Deep into the night, a glimmer of light shone through the red blind of Martha's bedroom. At times a vagrant wind would edge alongside the heavy green drapes of Maud's sitting room to reveal her hunched up in a high chair, a book clasped tightly in her hands. A late bus roared past, carrying nighttime office cleaners back to their homes. In the distance, a train clanked majestically by, the heavy load of freight cars swaying and rattling over the rails of a shunting yard. There came the wail of a siren. Police or ambulance, neither mattered to Maud, deeply immersed in her book. From the town hall clock came the chimes and the hour strike, indicating that the morning was progressing. At last, the light faded from Martha's bedroom. Soon, too, the downstairs light was extinguished from Maud's sitting room, and for a few brief moments a glimmer of brightness appeared in her bedroom. The clatter of the early morning milkman disturbed the peaceful scene. Soon there came the street cleaners with their trundling carts and metallic clangor. Buses swung into the streets for early morning workers to board and to be carried, yawning, to their jobs. Smoke appeared from myriad chimneys. Doors opened briefly and slammed hurriedly as people sped forth in the daily race with time and trains. At last the red blind of Martha's bedroom shot up with such violence that the pole tassel was set a-dancing. The startled, sleep
bleared face of Martha stared blankly upon an uncaring world. Her hair, set in tight curlers, gave her a wild, unkempt appearance, while a vast flannel nightdress accentuated her large size and more than ample endowments. Later, at the O'Haggis house, the door slowly opened and an arm stretched out to reach the milk bottles on the step. After a long interval, the door opened again, and Maud appeared, clad in a striped housecoat. Tiredly, she shook two mats, yawned violently, and withdrew again into the seclusion of her home. A solitary cat emerged from some dark passage, peered cautiously around before venturing to walk sedately to the roadway. Right in the center of the street he stopped, sat down, and did his toilet, face, ears, paws, and tail, before ambling off into some other dark corner in search of breakfast. End of chapter 1.